Kansas, not too far down the street from where I am. And he's just recently, well, actually not so recently, 2007, has moved on to the National Center for Science Education, where he works in helping to improve science literacy among the public. So,
try this, see if it works.
Well,
I never remember my dreams. And so now I'm really regretting that. Like, I wish that I did. Because I want dreams like that. I don't care. Just see if this works. Nope. Backwards. Okay. Try that then. Nope. Okay. Almost. Okay. Yes. Perfect. So, some of what I'm going to talk about here is probably familiar to you, and I'm not going over nature of science stuff because I think you don't know, but because I think that it's a useful way to get at issues that can be, it's a useful way to do science communication. It's a useful tool. So don't, if it seems like I'm talking beneath you, that's not the goal. It's more to sort of model how I have found it effective to talk about the nature of science and how I hope that you might be able to do the same things. So, with that said, as Keith mentioned, I work at the National Center for Science Education, where we're dedicated to defending evolution and now climate change in public schools, which I think is a laudable and noble goal, but not everyone agrees. This is a letter that we got. It was about a year ago. Oh, it's cutting off the beginning of it. Well, it says, so you're the dirty bastards responsible for shoving that liberal BS down our kids' throats. You should be ashamed. May God Almighty, creator of all things, have mercy on your souls. And I like to put that up, not because I necessarily agree with what this person was saying, but because I think it encapsulates a lot of what goes on around the supposed controversies around evolution and climate change and these things. That, I mean, where does our correspondent here go? They go to, they call us liberal, so it's politics, and they go to religion. So it's not, they're not saying, well, and I looked at this Archaeopteryx fossil and I have some questions about your character assessments. No, no, no. And you see the same thing. This is last year, the Miss USA pageant contestants were all asked what they, you know, just to extemporaneously respond to the question, should evolution be taught in public schools? And so you got answers like this. This is Miss Virginia USA saying, I think little bits and pieces of evolution should be taught in schools because it is a theory, and after all, we need to know about different theories so we can figure out what we want to believe is true. Miss Hawaii said that it should be taught in schools. We have creationism, it's her phrasing, and a lot of other ideas and opinions that are taught to children. So they're, you know, teach both sides, essentially. Talks about it as an opinion, really, throughout opinions and beliefs. Miss Washington, USA, said that it was, she thinks science is great and facts should be stated and we should know the facts, but, you know, evolution is a theory and little theories like evolution, I probably want to stay away from those. I believe in the truth and truth only. I think facts and theories should be, facts, not theories, should be taught. So that's, and those were sort of typical of the responses. I actually transcribed all of them for my sins. which should have been more fun to watch 15 minutes of Miss USA pageant contestants, but no. So, but there were some bright spots. Miss New Mexico said that I think evolution should be taught in schools because it's based off science. Science is a huge thing we need to continue to enrich our schools with. Sure. And Miss Vermont said I think it should be taught because not everyone has the same religious background, and it's important to have scientific facts about the world, and we do know that evolution exists, so we might as well learn about it. All right, I can go along with that. So one of the things that strikes me about this, looking at all 50 of the responses, is that the bad answers all talk about evolution as a belief. They present it's something like three quarters or more of them explicitly or implicitly framed it as there were two sides or maybe lots of sides, and all of them should be presented. In many cases, people said, well, yeah, I guess we teach religion in the schools, so we might as well put evolution in there too, which is not how I would have hoped they would have phrased it, but there it was. A lot of talk about opinion and belief, a lot of the same misconceptions that you saw in those quotes about what a theory is, that a theory is just, you know, oh, it's a little theory, it's someone's opinion, and that's fine, you can talk, but, you know, let's have facts, that facts are better than theories, which is not really how scientists tend to think about those, the relationship between those terms. And the good answers tended, as I think you saw there, to understand what science is and how science works. If they use words like theory, they use them right. They respect the status of evolution within science and all this. And this really is a theme that education researchers and others have seen a lot as well. This is a book from the National Academy of Sciences published in the 90s. Talking about teaching evolution and the nature of science as a way to get around some of the resistance that people feel. That when you introduce evolution, when you introduce topics that can be seen as controversial through that nature of science framework, it's a way to diffuse some of the tension that can come in. And it can also be a good way to help separate out what the nature of a supposed controversy might be. A way to say, are these questions that you're raising, are they scientific questions, or are they from some other domain of human experience? So this is from a website called understandingscience.org, which has all sorts of great resources for teachers. It's grade appropriate, so they've got a section for K through 2, 3 through 5, you know, middle school, high school, general audiences, and all sorts of good resources, teach lesson plans, other sorts of things that can be useful in the classroom as well. Exercises to use. And the themes here that they emphasize, that science focuses on the natural world, that it focuses on testability, reliance on empirical evidence, that it's a communal activity, it's not something that people do on their own, it's something that scientists get together and work together, they talk about it and hash out ideas, that it's an iterative process, and that it's a way of behaving. These are all really key ideas that help separate science from other disciplines like religion, like art and aesthetics, which is not to say that science is better. Saying that something isn't, that a given argument is not a scientific argument, is not to say that it's a bad argument or that it's worse. It's just different. And so understanding science and these other resources have developed some good tools to navigate around some of the misconceptions that can come up around science. And what I've certainly found, and that we've found at NCSE a lot, is one of the big misconceptions that often comes up and that's we often reinforce through science education is the idea of science as an encyclopedia, that it's a collection of facts, and if you want to know about the Krebs cycle, you go and you pull off the K encyclopedia and you read about it, and that's that. But that's not what you do as scientists, right? That's not what science is about. What makes science interesting is not this encyclopedia aspect of it. It's that science is this process. And the idea of the scientific method that is often taught in schools is way too simple. It's this linear, simple progression that you ask a question, formulate a hypothesis, perform an experiment, yada, yada. That's not how science actually works. And presenting science in age appropriate, but in its glory and complexity as a process can be a really valuable tool. This is, again, from Understanding Science. It's a diagram that they've come up with that better expresses how scientists actually do what they do. And that with testability and that testing aspect of science at the center of it as this really key defining trait of what science is and what separates it in many ways from other disciplines. But in interplay with other parts and things from that simple linear approach to the nature of science still show up. So within the exploration and discovery sphere, they talk about making observations and asking questions and sharing data and ideas and the various ways that people find inspiration for the scientific questions that they choose to ask, which then feeds back into how they test those questions, but also feeds into their interaction with the rest of the scientific community and how they judge the benefits and outcomes of the research they do. The testing comes in both gathering the data, either through observational or manipulative experiments in the lab. And to me, the distinction that can be drawn between historical and experimental sciences, that's a really fine line. And I, you know, for me, I think that this works just as well regardless. So I'm not, you know, this is a session on earth sciences, historical sciences, but nothing that I'm saying here doesn't work equally well for anything else. The community aspect, the that you publish, that you try to replicate other people's results, rigorous processes of peer review so that scientists are looking over each other's shoulders and helping keeping each other honest, and that science is done by people, that it's done in a community of researchers who, again, are looking over each other's shoulders and are thinking about the implications of that work. It's not done by some ivory tower elite. It's done by people who live in the community and are part of the same world. And I think that that is easy to get lost in the way that we often report on science, the way that we teach about science. It tends to be, here's what we've learned, rather than here's how we got to what we've learned. Here's how this information that we're presenting to you, where it comes from. And that backstory is a really valuable part of convincing people that it's that what we're trying to tell them is reliable. And it also, it makes it for better lessons. This is something that the afternoon keynote speaker sort of stole my thunder on this, because I was going to talk about the importance of storytelling and all this, but you got that already midday. So I'll just, baseball statistics, for most people, not the most exciting thing in the world, but you get Aaron Sorkin to write the story and you cast Brad Pitt in it, sure, that doesn't hurt. And you make it a lot more interesting to talk about baseball, why doing statistics right in baseball rather than, actually considering not just measures of location, but measures of variance and choosing statistics that actually tell you something interesting about why a baseball team wins and loses, that it actually makes it work better. Putting that in the context of a human conflict, talking to people about why that works and why that was resisted and how Bill James and Billy Beane had to fight against entrenched opinion, that makes what could be this really, really, really dry, dull. I mean, if you've tried to read Baseball Abstract, it's not the most fun reading. But if you make that into a story, and the nature of science is the story of how the encyclopedia information got there. So it's really two birds with one stone. It's storytelling is the greatest information communication tool humans have ever invented, and there's no reason that we shouldn't be using that in our science communications. And the same thing with The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. I don't know how many of you have read this, but soon to be a HBO movie produced by Oprah Winfrey. It's HeLa cells have touched every piece of medical technology. Every drug that you take has probably at some point been in touch with a HeLa cell. But how did it get there? What are these cell culture lines? Where do they come from? It's from a cervical cancer from this woman, Henrietta Lacks, whose name was forgotten for decades, and who Rebecca Skloot went back and talked to her orphans, because this cancer killed her. But these cells that were taken from this cancer were sent up into space. They were used to create the polio vaccine. There's this huge contribution to society and to science that have come from these cells. And putting a face on it, putting a story on it, means that people who would not otherwise read cell biology books want to read this book. So talking about that scientific process, talking about the human stories behind it, can be a really important tool for getting around some of the barriers that people put up when you start talking to them about science. And by doing this, you emphasize some key things that, again, have been shown in research. Most of this research done especially around evolution education, some of it around climate change and other topics that generate controversy in classrooms, talking about science as a process that is tentative, that it's not, we don't make a pronouncement that is true forever and ever. It's something that we revisit and we continue testing. But that because of the safeguards inherent in the process, it's also robust. It's not that tentativeness is not a weakness, it's a source of strength for science. That we test the ideas and how we test them, that it's based in empirical data. It's not based on personal opinion. It's not based on personal revelation. There are different disciplines that are appropriate for that, but it's not saying that it's bad to do things another way. But in science, this is what works, and this is what gives it that robustness. That it's a social process, and that biases can come into it through that social process, but that the social process is also, again, a source of robustness, that you do have people looking over your shoulders and checking your results, and that it's human. And that means that it's not perfect, it's flawed, but it's also perfectible. And talking about it that way gets people's fingers out of their ears. It gets them, it breaks through those barriers and gets them to hear what they might not otherwise want to hear, as the first two speakers in this session have talked about a lot. And it's also talking about the nature, these values in science, the things that drove us into science, that make us care about science, the principles of testing. If you videotape children playing with a new toy, they do controlled experiments with it. You know, if you give them a box and two little balls, that when you put both of the balls on the box, it lights up. And then you just leave them to play. They'll first take one ball and put it there and see if it lights up, then they'll take the other one and put it there and see if it lights up, put both of them there. And then if you glue them together, they'll actually hold it on an edge so they can do that same experiment. So the idea of doing a controlled experiment is not something that you have to be taught. It is there naturally. You just have to find ways to bring that out in your audiences. And one of the key tools that also works to do that is to talk about your shared values, that it is human, science is a human process. So your values as a presenter, your values as a scientist, the shared background that you have with your audience can be really key things. And you know, one example of that is this guy you may recognize, Francis Collins, director of the National Institutes of Health. He's the sequencer of the human genome, guitar hero. Also, obvious, of course, as you know, evangelical Christian, who's written extensively about both his faith and his work as a scientist, his support for evolution, stem cell research, a range of other contentious scientific topics. And he's a very effective voice on those issues because he has that background, and because people who might want to dismiss his views can't say that he's a bad scientist, because he's head of the NIH, right? He sequenced the human genome. So his scientific credentials are strong, and his religious credentials are strong. So people who might want to just blithely dismiss evolution, when it comes from someone like him, and folks like you, it's a lot harder to just say, well, you're just an atheist, so what do you know? So they have to actually confront what he's saying, and that opens up doors. The same thing happens around climate change, where there's research that if you present people with two statements, and I had a slide on this and I took it out, but now I'm putting it back in. If you give people one of two statements, either a statement that says, climate change, we're a society of environmental scientists and we think that climate change is happening and it's caused by humans, and to solve it, we need to impose a carbon tax that's going to be expensive and make your lives and increase regulations. Or you give them a statement that says, we're a group of environmental scientists and we think that climate change is happening and it's caused by humans, and to solve it, we need to build more nuclear power plants. If you give both of those statements to people who are inclined not to think that climate change is happening, culturally speaking, they just are averse to the idea. If you give them the second statement that talks about nuclear power, they're much more willing, if you ask them after that, is climate change happening? You ask them the scientific question, not the policy question. They're more likely to think that climate change is happening and is caused by humans if they're presented with a solution that fits their cultural preferences. Psychology is weird, but there are ways to work with that and to respect that and to build consensus on that basis. These same sorts of techniques work when we are presented with people who say, well, this science is controversial. We should treat it as a controversy. Bringing it back to the nature of science, rather than arguing about the minutiae of the particular claims being made, you know, someone says, well, I think that Archaeopteryx fossils are bogus, so evolution is wrong. You can spend a lot of time arguing about Archaeopteryx without actually getting anywhere, because you're not getting at the real issues at hand. And one way to help do that is to bring it back to the nature of science, to say, okay, here's how science works. if this Archaeopteryx fossil is bad, if evolution is problematic, then we should be seeing in the scientific literature, in the peer-reviewed literature, we should be seeing signs of this. We should be seeing people abandoning evolution or adopting something else. So let's see what scientific bodies, what groups of scientists have said. Is there a consensus that has come out of that? Because science is a social process. It's a human activity. What about databases of peer-reviewed papers? Publicly available things like PubMed and Google Scholar. And when people call NCSE, and sometimes people just call wanting to pick a fight, they don't really have an agenda, they just sort of want to yell at someone for a while. And what I'll say is, look, if you think that evolution is on its way out, go to PubMed and do this search yourself. I'm not going to do it for you, but, you know, teach a man to fish. Go and look and see what are people saying about evolution. And if you've got this alternative, if you think that this issue is a problem, go and search in Google Scholar, go and search in PubMed and see not just what one paper says that maybe someone gave you because they think that it'll support their views, but what does everything say that you pull up from that search? What is the trend there? For especially, you know, younger audiences or people who may not have the scientific background to do that sort of searching and to integrate all that, the right sort of a Wikipedia entry that is peer-reviewed in a different way, and you can check and see whether that peer review has actually been done on it. Is there an active talk page? Is there a general consensus in the discussion? Are there good references that seem accurate? And similarly, science blogs written by scientists in the field who are digesting some of the information and saying, this is how cell biologists like me look at this issue, can be a good way at getting at some of these things when it's harder to get at a scientific consensus statement or for someone to be able to interpret the literature. And distinguishing science from things that are not science can also be a good way to make political controversies political, to say, okay, yes, there, you know, people often say, well, you say that there's not a controversy about evolution, but look, we're having a fight over evolution, so there must be a controversy, which is true. There is a controversy. It's just not a scientific controversy. And so what would make a scientific controversy different from a political controversy? A controversy over climate change policy is different from a controversy over whether climate change is happening. And distinguishing that and talking about what are the scientific issues and separating them for the political issues or cultural issues or religious issues is effective and relies on that background in nature of science. It's also important. It's easy. People often want to have debates. They want to say, well, we'll have one newspaper column says this, and then, you know, do a pro and con thing and just give both equal sign to both sides. And sometimes that's appropriate, and sometimes it's not. So if you did that on evolution, if you wanted to have scientific opinion that was roughly matched the state of opinion of actual scientists, you would give 100 times as much space to the pro-evolution side as to the anti-evolution side, and I don't think people would tend to go for that. So on a lot of issues, it's worth just reminding people that, you know, opinions on the shape of the Earth don't differ. Not everything is open for debate at this point. And then, sorry, I jumped ahead faster than I expected. And shifting from, if the topic is science, if you're in a science class, you're in a scientific setting, shifting from the political or the cultural debate to a legitimate scientific debate. There's not a debate over whether evolution happens, but the particulars, which is more important, neutral evolution or natural selection, in the arc of evolutionary history? Were dinosaurs warm-blooded? These sorts of questions are closer to being subjects of debate. I think the dinosaur warm-blooded thing is pretty well resolved at this point, but was at least controversial more recently than whether evolution happens. So shifting and explaining why this is a legitimate scientific debate and this is not any longer a legitimate scientific debate gets back to these same nature of science issues. And those can be introduced not even talking about the contentious issue. You can set up nature of science using simple experiments that everybody's comfortable with. The equivalent of the toy with the two balls that make it light up. Walk people through, this is how we test things. This is the process in a field where people are comfortable. And then moving forward to something that's more contentious. So these are really the... From understanding science, there are other sources out there, but helping people distinguish science from non-science and understand how, where scientific knowledge comes from. Where are these claims that they find contentious or dubious? Where do they come from? How were they tested? What's the background on them? Can be a really effective way to diffuse controversy and to move scientific understanding forward without having to pick fights with people or get into making it personal in ways that are unproductive. And that's what we found effective at NCSE, and I hope that you also find it useful.